offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you all to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. This is a special satsang in the sense that we are culminating a beautiful journey that we've had for the past many months. Today we will be hopefully concluding the Bhagavata Vahini that Swami has written, and we had the opportunity to go through with all of you. The story is very, very beautiful, written in a way that Swami wishes that we learn the message from it. Because as we have been saying, when we even went through the Ramkatha Rasvahini, we had spoken of how it is different from the Ramayana written by Valmiki and the others. And clearly, the message that Swami wishes that we all take from it is what Swami has placed emphasis on even as he narrates the story. And that's what we can see even in the Bhagavata Vahini. In fact, even till the last chapter, you will see that the message is loud and clear. And we all should be really grateful to be able to go back to this, revisit the book that Swami has written. And it is there for all of us to draw our sustenance from. We are grateful for that. Once again, we offer our most grateful pranams at Swami's lotus feet for that. Before we carry on with the story and conclude it this week, let's invite Brother Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem, and Sairam to all our listeners. Once again, it's that feeling that I felt as we reached the conclusion of the Ramkatha Rasavahini. It is a feeling of fulfillment. At the same time, there is a tinge of sadness because such a beautiful thing is over. But if I allow that sadness to overwhelm me, I think I would have failed in understanding the basic lesson of the Bhagavata Vahini. Because if at all anything that we should learn from the Bhagavata Vahini, it is this, that everything that is born is bound to die. It is the manner in which we face the end that determines who we are, that decides who we are. And therefore, I think I will not allow that sadness to stay. Instead, I will do what Parikshit did, which is listen to and talk about the glory of God. Because as long as we are immersed in God, we become one with God. Then like God, we have no beginning, we have no end. There's nothing to celebrate or mourn as such. It becomes one endless journey of complete and infinite bliss. And so we dive back into the story, the last part of the story where we had left off last week. Parikshit has asked Sage Shuka to narrate the story of Krishna's birth. It's very interesting that as his moment of death is coming close, he is wanting to hear about birth of God. I think that's also very metaphorical, the way Swami has placed it, because this is the end of Dehabhimana, this is the birth of Atmabhimana for Parikshit. This is the end of the physical journey, but this is the beginning of his spiritual journey where he is going to attain the lotus feet of the Lord. And that is so symbolically and metaphorically depicted in the last chapter, because as Parikshit is nearing his death, the time for the birth of Lord Krishna is nearing. And though I am giving away the suspense here, it is so beautiful, so poetic, so romantic that with the birth of Krishna, the death of Parikshit happens. It is so beautiful, so poignant the way Swami has narrated it. And I think that is the message that is shown, that if you lead your life with God as your focus, that is what will happen. It will lead to the destruction of Dehabhimana and the birth of Atmabhimana.
As we have said many times, especially when we started the Bhagavata Vahini Satsang, we had spoken of the role that sage Vedavyasa plays. And you know, we are talking about Vedanta, the one who has compiled all the Vedas, the one who has given the essence of Vedanta. You know, that is whom Vedavyasa is. And we're talking about Sukha Maharishi, who is supposed to be the son of such a illustrious father and himself an illustrious being in that sense. And he is telling the story for the redemption of Parikshit. In fact, as we have mentioned many times before, it is for the redemption of mankind through this very avid listener of Parikshit. But it is so very symbolic that the redemption lies in the story. And as you said, the story is written in such a way by Swami that the moment of reckoning when it comes for Parikshit is when the Lord enters the human realm. And that is what an avatar actually brings, that opportunity to release yourself in a manner that you cannot imagine. you know, yes, the Vedanta has the essence of all knowledge, and that knowledge that liberates. That's what Swami would say, sa vidya ya vimuktaye. That knowledge which can liberate is contained in all these esoteric texts. But to be able to access that knowledge, I think you need a lot of intellectual preparedness for that. Not all of us can attain it. You know, in spite of all our extensive exposure to spiritual literature, I don't think we can take up a very esoteric Upanishad and be able to relate to it straight away. But when the Lord comes down in a human form, as we have seen through the entire childhood of Krishna, He has made the higher states of spiritual enlightenment available even to a cowherd, even to simple women who are churning milk, churning butter from curds, or, you know, a lady who has come selling flowers and selling fruits. He has made that higher state available to each one of them. The king, who is supposed to be lost in the matters of the world, the entire, I mean, the realm of enlightenment is available to him just by listening to the Lord. And that is the essence of the avatar being born. And so beautifully Swami has written that as his time comes to an end, you know, he is urging to listen about how the Lord came into the human form, how the Lord came into the human realm.
It is actually implying the statement that the descent of God is for the ascent of man, because here as the descent of God happens, the ascent of man too occurs. So we were relating the story where Kamsa hears the celestial voice, because of which he gets very fearful. He decides to cut the neck of his sister Devaki instantly, but good sense prevails when Vasudeva speaks to him, therefore he spares the life of his sister. And later on, he also spares the life of the children born to Devaki, because Kamsa feels that after all, it's only the eighth child that's going to kill me. Why should I bother and destroy such sweetness, such innocence? So he allows, and six children are born. But then, you know, the play of fate has to go on, and playing his role in this play of fate is the celestial sage Narada, who comes to Kamsa and fills him with fresh fear and fresh dread, because of which, you know, Kamsa thinks of all possible scenarios. Actually, he starts even thinking of impossible scenarios. It has clearly been told that it's the eighth child that's going to kill you, but now, as they say, Vinasha Kale Vipreeta Buddhi. When the time of destruction comes near, the faculty of discrimination goes haywire. That is what happens to Kamsa. He is not able to discriminate. And Narada too, you know, we pointed out multiple ways in which he does it. One of which is pointing to a flower with eight petals and asking which is the first petal, which is the eighth petal. So in this way, he plays on Kamsa's fear and makes his doubts grow large and large and large. In fact, the statement that Narada says in the end, take every day that you manage to live as equal to a decade or more. Do not disregard death as a distant contingency. This is Narada's parting words to Kamsa, and Kamsa is really so scared. Because of which, you know, he decides that, let me kill all the other children also. And he summons Vasudeva and he shouts at him. He's in all fury and anger, and he tells him, get how many children are there now? And when he gets to know six are born, he says, oh my God, six, get all of them right away to me. And Vasudeva knows what is going to be the fate of these babies. But what is interesting here is to note that just as faith grows, you know, faith needs nourishment, faith needs conviction, faith needs us to keep nurturing its roots so that it goes deep and becomes firm. That is how, in sharp contrast to that, doubt grows so fast. That is why, you know, they say climbing up is a tough task. It's a slow task. It's an arduous, painful task. But coming crashing down is very easy. It is equally painful, but it's very easy. Climbing up a ladder is difficult. Falling down is so easy. And that is how it is even in faith and doubt. That is how we must be so guarded against doubt. Because the smallest seed of doubt sprouts like a weed. in the heart. But the seed of faith needs years of nurturing, care and watering for it to grow strong and the roots to go deep. Yes, of course, once the root goes deep and the tree of faith is firmly standing there, it will bear sweet fruits and nothing can affect the tree. No weed, nothing. Even the weeds get shelter from the tree. Even the stray animals that destroy that faith get shade from the tree. That is true. But in sharp contrast, doubt is like a weed which grows instantly, and therefore, you know, Swami would urge us, Swami would tell all of us that when you embark on this path, on the spiritual path, when you seek a master, when you take someone as your God, when you take a form as your God and start worshipping, don't get into intellectual understanding or intellectual debate and criticism, because doubt is like that weed. A weed that grows super fast and strangles the main plant of faith itself. That is why I think Swami emphasized so much on the bhakti marga. Because bhakti is the fertilizer, bhakti is the water that nourishes this sapling called faith. And once it becomes strong, once you become strong in bhakti, automatically jnana comes, automatically you will be able to ward away all these weeds called doubts.
But the other beautiful point that Sukamahashi says here is, you know, why should somebody like Narada come and play this role, if you wonder in that sense? Because, I mean, if you don't know the story, if you don't know the character of Narada, you might think that he's a, you know, a sinister conspirator in this whole plan, who is coming and, you know, the evil person is actually beginning to transform, and you come and you turn him back into the bad ways.
You ignite, know, right? You provoke him.
Right? You literally are the bad company here. But that's why Sukamahashi adds that, you know, Narada does not do anything without a purpose. And Narada is always one who is part of the Lord's plan. You know, that is what you learn when you read the whole scriptures. He's always who furthers what is God's will in a manner which is not clearly understandable when you look at it. But when you look back, it is all a beautiful play.
Absolutely. Be it Prahlada, be it Dhruva. There also it is Narada only who comes and guides them to their highest levels of attainment. And in the large perspective, when we see, it is Narada who actually guides Kamsa towards his highest attainment also.
Right. And then Sukamahashi says that, you know, when you look at the story, you might think that, you know, why such a sin should be done by Kamsa and why such a sin should be encouraged by somebody like Narada. But then Sukha says that it is not easy to understand what led these children to go through this fate. Who knows, it might be a curse that they were being released from. In fact, a similar episode happens even in the Mahabharata when, you know, Shantanu marries Ganga, and she says that whatever I do, you should not question me. And I think nine children, is it?
Seven children she stole. Eighth is Bhishma.
The seven children, she, every time a child is born, she goes and drowns the child in the river. And the eighth time, Shantanu is not able to hold himself back and he asks the question and she says that you've broken the pact, I have to leave. But then she also says that those eight children whom she drowned were actually great sages.
The seven Vasus curses or something like that, right. Yeah.
They have some curse because of which they have to be born as a human, but they don't have to live an entire life and then again get entangled in the Maya. So she was actually, you know, giving them deliverance by the act that she was doing. Similarly, you know, that's what Sukamahashi says, that you don't know whether this is actually cruelty being meted out to them or deliverance being offered to them through this act. But definitely it must be something of a deliverance nature, because of what we saw, even the asuras whom Krishna had, you know, in his childhood dealt with, they were all people who had curses and were actually released from that curse. And that's what Sukamahashi hints, that you look at all of this as a play and, you know, don't judge the people who are involved in that.
And that is where faith and surrender comes. You know, what is the proof that this is not a sin, but this is actually redemption? That is just faith. That is just surrender. Surrender which comes from the feeling that whatever is happening is as per the master plan and therefore it is good. That kind of surrender is necessary. You know, even if you take a normal instance of watching a movie, if you step into the theater or you start watching the movie in the last 10 minutes, and you have no idea of the plot, nothing, you are just watching the last 10 minutes of the movie, there is a good chance that you may mistake the villain to be the hero because he is suffering so much. You know, you may feel how much injustice is being meted out to the villain. But you know, for whatever reason, possibly because at least in Indian movies, there are standard villains and standard heroes. And so is the case with even Hollywood and other movies also. Generally, it is standard hero and standard villain. So because of that knowledge, possibly, even though I step into the movie at a time when I don't know anything else, but I see the villain being subjected to trouble, or because ultimately good has to triumph. And when I see the villain suffering, I don't say, oh my God, what is this unfair? What is this injustice happening? I say, no, he definitely has done something. I don't know the movie, but I'm sure that he's just getting what he deserves. You know, that kind of faith and confidence that I have in a movie, I think we should have it in life also. Because this movie called Life has been going on from so many years. We don't know. We are stepping in at different points of time in that movie. And basing on what we are seeing, if we make judgment and if we think that something is going wrong, I think we are only deluding ourselves. That is why, just like we show faith in the movie, in the director, and in general goodness there, I know that no, if he's suffering, he has done something bad. So in the same way, if I can have that faith that there is no injustice that's happening, everything is fair. When they say all is fair in love and war, God is the epitome of the greatest and highest love. So therefore, everything that he does is fair. Everything is perfect. It's just that my vision is not perfect. So I think that is what Shuka conveys to us, actually, because I don't think Parikshit needed this. He is already convinced. He's already in a state of total surrender. But as we said, the Bhagavata is for our own benefit. And that's why Shuka conveys this, because he knows that this Bhagavata is going to be staying for times immemorial. And therefore, he gives out this important message that irrespective of what happens, it's all for the good. It's all according to the master plan. There is nothing like the sin that is happening here, even when Kamsa is killing all these babies.
There's a very subtle way, Swami, I think, is expressing the change in even Parikshit's outlook. And probably that is the lesson that we all have to learn, because I think when we did the satsang, even on the topic of Shravanam or listening, and Swami always gives the example of Parikshit as one who attained the ultimate just through that one act of sitting and listening. And there we often said that, you know, the art of listening itself is probably very different from how we do it most of the time. And one of the things which would often be spoken of is the ability to listen to a story without making any judgments on anybody. It's actually very, very difficult. If you listen to any story, if you see a drama, if you see a movie, you will invariably get into the movie and you will start feeling the emotions, because that is what the media is supposed to do to you. But the ability to look at it as a witness, if you are able to do that, you will be able to carry that into life too. And you can in a way see that that is the state Parikshit is being led towards. Because one of the things that he asks, and we had a brief discussion about that last week also, where he looks at Sukamashi and says, you know, how is Kamsa behaving like this? When he has been told that his end is coming, how is he not doing that which will actually relieve him from, birth and death? And Sukamashi laughs at it and says that you think that everybody is going to be thinking like you. The same information was given to you and you reacted in a certain way and you think everybody will react like that. And of course, that very, very beautiful statement that Swami makes, which you made a reference to, Vinasha Kale Viparita Buddhi. Sukamashi says, if you see death as Vinasha or destruction, then your mind gets corrupted and you'll start doing stupid things. But if you see death as an opportunity, if you see death as inevitable because it is coming to me and how do I best face it, then automatically the action that you will take will be noble. And that's what he tells him. And of course, after that, Parikshit being the humble person, he says, no, I am not great. It's not any merit to me. It's because I am born in this lineage. It's because of my uncle being Krishna. It's because of my grandparents and all of that, he says. And at one point he says, but why am I wasting my time with all this? You know, I am not here to qualify whether I am good or someone else is good or somebody is bad. He said, let me not do all of this. Let me just think of Krishna. I think probably there Swami is hinting that his listening is becoming more and more non-judgmental. He is just saying that, let me just look at it. And Swami would often say, the ability to look at what is happening around you just as a mere witness. And just seeing everything as God's play. And that is what will happen. That is what Sukamashi is saying. Can you just look at all these events and say that these are all part of God's play?
This is just the Bhagavatam.
This is just the Bhagavatam. Just be on the side of Krishna and just witness it. Don't be on the side of, I mean, if you're even in the side of a devotee, you will feel that, oh, when is God going to come? When am I going to be given relief? When is he in the miracle going to happen? But Swami would often say this, look at the whole world from my point of view, just as it happens. And, you know, you're just sitting with Swami, you know that at the right time he's going to step in, he's going to do what is to be done. But that anticipation, not restlessness, not despondency, but just witnessing it with, just you seeing the Bhagavatam, as you said.
While going through this part, actually I feel this is a gem that Swami has embedded so beautifully. Personally, it was a revelation for me, a new meaning, a new direction for this statement, Vinashakale Viparita Buddhi. Because whenever we hear it in translated in Bhagwan's discourses by the different translators, it's always translated as when the time of death comes, the sense of discrimination goes haywire. That is what I quoted also. And when it is said like this, you often wonder, what should I do, Swami, so that when my Vinashakale comes, my buddhi doesn't go viparita. What should I do so that when my time of reckoning comes, my discrimination doesn't desert me? And Swami has given that answer in such a creative manner, possibly giving the credit to Shuka, because I feel that is what it is. It is Swami's gem. Swami simplifies the most esoteric and difficult truths into such simple language and way it is delivered. Swami says that if you think of death as the end, then alone will your discrimination go haywire. Means even at the time of the death of the body, if you are steeped in the conviction that this is not the end, this is not Vinasha. Why? Because Atma is something, Nainam Chindyanti Shastrani, it is something that can't be destroyed by weapons, it can't be wet by water, it can't be burnt by fire, it cannot be vaporized by a atomic nuclear attack. Nothing can happen to the Atma, and I am that Atma. When you are immersed in that Satya, in that truth, then even when the body is on the verge of death, you know that you are not dying. It is not a Vinashakale. It is not the time of destruction. And therefore, even at that point in time, your discrimination will be discriminating. It will be perfect. What a lovely message it is. It is not about trying to live forever, trying to sustain the body and the mind forever. It is all about growing in conviction, growing spiritually with the conviction that I am not the body. Giving up Dehabhimana and going towards Atmabhimana. That is a beautiful message, and it was so thrilling to read this. And dear listeners, this is the magical thing about Swami's Bhagavatam or any of Swami's writings, that in between, as Swami is coming towards what we consider as a complex truth, in a way that only the avatar can do, he simplifies it and presents it in such a different light, in such a different perspective, that, you know, after reading it, you feel, oh my God, it is so simple. Why couldn't I think of it? That's how you feel. It feels so natural that this is the interpretation. This is the actual meaning. And you wonder, how is it that I couldn't get this? It's so nostalgic of what would happen in our math classes, you know, in third standard, fourth grade. You're sitting there and you feel that this is the toughest problem ever that humanity can face. And the next day morning on the blackboard, the teacher does it and you feel, oh my God, how couldn't I think of this? It is so easy. That is the kind of universal teacher that we have, and for that we should forever be grateful.
You know, last week when we were talking, we were discussing about what Swami would say about old age coming, and then you try to hide it by doing the different things. There's another discourse where Swami makes a very beautiful point. He says, you know, why do we always try to do such things? When we are ill, we try to go to a doctor and get better, or when we are faced with a disease which could terminate our life, we try to extend our life. Swami makes a very beautiful point. He says, inherently, you know that you are immortal. He says, inherently, you know that you are beyond destruction. And you're actually always striving for that. The only problem is, right now in your state of mind, you think you're the body. So you try to make the body immortal. And that's precisely what somebody like Kamsa is doing. And, you know, death has been announced to him. And he's trying to see, how do I attain that immortality through this body or maintain the life of this body? But what Parikshit is doing is just the other. He's saying, okay, this body is going to end, but I have to find that I'm immortal before that end comes. And that's precisely what Swami is saying, as you beautifully explained, that vinasha can happen only to the body. And if you're trying to battle that, you'll be doing all kinds of stupid things like what Kamsa did. But on the other hand, if you say that the body is anyway going to perish, but before that perishing happens, I need to establish that I am not this body and I have to understand the immortality of the soul that I am. And then you will strive for the right things. And Swami would say, when that happens, you will automatically do the right things all your life. And when death comes calling, you will do what Parikshit is doing.
Beautiful. Meanwhile, in the story, you know, what has happened is, Kamsa has killed the 6 babies and the 7th pregnancy for Mother Devaki actually ends in abruptly because it's an aborted child. And Vasudeva is between the horns of a dilemma. Should he tell this to Kamsa or should he not tell? Because this is a very tragic thing and we can understand that nobody would like to convey news of an abort or a miscarriage. So he thinks, why should I tell Kamsa also? Because anyway, the child is dead, you know, it can't do anything. But actually, the child is not dead. And I think that suspense we will reveal after the break. Dear listeners, what happens next and the final culmination of this Bhagavata Vahini, we will be proceeding after this break. So don't go away anywhere. We'll take a quick little break and be back soon.
Krishna ni begani baro Krishna ni begani baro 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 Krishna ni begani baro Bye. ಜಗದೋಧಾರಕ ನಮ್ಮ ಜಗದೋಧಾರಕ ನಮ್ಮ ಜಗದೋಧಾರಕ ನಮ್ಮ ಉಡುಪಿ ಶ್ರೀ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಜಗದೋಧಾರಕ ನಮ್ಮ ಉಡುಪಿ ಶ್ರೀ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಕೃಷ್ಣನೇ ಬೇಗನೆ ಬೇಗನೆ ಬಾರೋ ಕೃಷ್ಣನೇ ಬೇಗನೆ
Welcome back, dear listeners. Even as that song asks for Krishna to come soon, that is what the whole world is asking for because it's unable to bear the tyranny of Kamsa. That is what Parikshit's heart is also yearning for because it is said that what you think of in the last moment of your life is what decides the future, and Parikshit is desperately wanting to only think of Krishna. And we should also be soon welcoming Krishna, but before that, as we said before the break, the seventh child is actually a miscarriage which Vasudeva doesn't tell Kamsa. In reality, what has happened is, as far as the divine master plan of Krishna is concerned, a playmate is necessary for Krishna, and possibly because the brother Lakshmana had been younger in the previous avatar, in this avatar he is given the chance of being the elder brother. And the fetus is actually transported into the womb of Rohini. She is the second wife of
Nanda.
At Gokula, and that is how Balrama is transported.
I'm sorry, I think she is another wife of Vasudeva only, who is living in Gokula.
Oh, is it right. Okay? That is something we need to check about, and we are sorry for that confusion. But anyway. The embryo is transported into the womb of Rohini, and that is where it grows. So that is the reason this child appears like a miscarriage, because it's only the defunct body. The jiva has already been transported there. And when Vasudeva doesn't inform this to Kamsa, Kamsa gets to know about it later on through his security guards. He feels that, you know, this is what is Vinashakale Viprita Buddhi. He feels that this Vasudeva is trying to hide the child and secretly nurture a child who can kill him. He doesn't realize that the six children, without batting an eyelid, Vasudeva brought and offered it to him to brutally kill. He forgets all that. This is what is Vinashakale Viprita Buddhi. And that is why it is almost as if deep within Kamsa, some negative tendencies that had accumulated have now got an expression, like lava exploding out of a volcano. In a similar manner, all evil and ugly tendencies which are inherent in Kamsa start sprouting forth. This is that Viparita Buddhi showing itself. And therefore Kamsa now says, oh my god, you are doing this much secrecy for the seventh child itself. Wonder what you will do for the eighth child, which is going to kill me. And therefore, strangely, he imprisons both Vasudeva and Devaki, puts them even in chains and doubles the guard and starts spending even more sleepless nights. This is how Kamsa reacts to something which happens like this. I'm sure that even as Parikshit is listening, he will be wondering how can a person react like this, because that is not Parikshit's nature to react in that manner. But what is Parikshit's nature? You know, I think this little point we missed out. Parikshit's nature is such, as you pointed out so beautifully, Prem, that he's becoming totally non-judgmental. So much so, he goes on to even justify on Kamsa's behalf. You know, Parikshit says to Sage Shuka that, see, you say that it is the good fortune, it is the good thoughts, it is a noble deed that I have done that I am like this, but I don't think I could have done all that had it not been for the guidance from my grandfathers, had it not been for the guidance and love of my father, my parents, my gurus, the courtiers that I have, the advisors that I have in the kingdom, the general people in the kingdom. If they had not been people who nurture virtues and gunas, sadgunas, I don't think I would have been like this. Therefore, whatever I am today, it is credit to all these people. Therefore, there's nothing great about me. It's all the company that I have kept. And he goes on and says, in the similar vein, I don't think it is Kamsa's fault alone that he is like that. He must not have had proper advisors. He must not have had a proper upbringing. He must not have had a proper treatment from society. And therefore, he says that for a tyrant like Kamsa to be like that, if you call him a tyrant, it is also the part responsibility of the environment in which he grew, the society in which he grew, and therefore I don't think it is right for us to fault Kamsa. That is the kind of non-judgmental person that Parikshit has become. He says this, and this is precisely the kind of noble gunas in a person that makes him see always good, and Shuka highlights this for Parikshit.
Absolutely, and it is at this point that Sukumarshi explains that what one does at the moment of death or when one is approaching death cannot be different from what one does when one is living life without the knowledge of death. And it is not like what Parikshit is asking, you know, the moment the knowledge of death has come, I have reacted in a certain way, why isn't Kamsa or why doesn't everybody else react in this way? And he says that is not how it works. It is like what you have been all your life is what will decide how you react when that news is given to you.
Just and a concentrated form maybe.
Exactly. And you just react spontaneously, or you react impulsively. And whatever you do impulsively is what you are. It's not what you, you know, pretend to be. That will never happen when you're in the, you know, when you're put in a moment of stress. And that's why he says that clearly people are of two kinds. They're either of the demonic kind or of the divine kind. And this is decided about based on how you live your life. If you've lived a life of compassion, if you've lived a life of every time you had an opportunity, you helped the person who was in need, if you've thought of the other person's comfort and needs more than yours, that is all the attributes which are representative of a divine life. If you've led like that, then when you approach death, then you will say what is the best thing to do. And you will only try to do more of the good that you've done all your life. But if you've been a demonic person, and I think many times it has occurred to me also, you know, if somebody comes and says you have only 1 week to go, invariably you'll think of what are the things I can pack that 1 week with so that I can enjoy maximum. Because that's what we do all our life. We are only trying to draw out the joy out of life. So when life is suddenly going to be shortened, you'll think how much more joy can I draw out of this life. But if you are a person whose nature is to give joy to others, you will only wonder how much more joy can I do, or how much more purposeful I can make this little time that is left of me. And that is what Sukha is saying.
And he actually gives two terms also. He says the two attitudes are Deva and Asura. Deva is the divine and Asura is the demonic. These are the traits that get concentrated and expressed when you know that the final moment of reckoning has come. And since it's only a concentration of your attitudes and feelings, therefore how we respond at the time of death is very, very completely influenced by how we have led our entire life. So it is not as if it's a shortcut that I do all sorts of nonsense in my life, do whatever I wish, violate dharma, be flagrant about it, and then as the moment of death comes, I take Krishna's name, I get liberated. It's not at all possible. Because all said and done, though I might manage to take up Krishna's name also, as Swami tells in the Chinnakatha, My thought will immediately move away from Krishna because I have not been habituated to keep thinking about Krishna. So, this is what Shuka explains to Parikshit, and he says that all these people who have the Deva attitude, who have the divine attitude, they attain Kaivalya or beatitude. And the latter, that is the demonic, they achieve only Naraka or hell. So, once he says this, that is when actually Parikshit tells Shuka that, you know, why am I listening to all of these? I don't want to listen to this. I want to focus only on Krishna. Please proceed, you know. I want to know what happened with the birth of Krishna, because till now Shuka has explained about the seventh child, and Shuka also sensing the eagerness, he says, yes. It was at the time of greatest pain that Krishna came, you know. They say that the night is darkest before the dawn. That is how it happened, because Devaki and Vasudeva were possibly in the lowest in their life in every sense, physically, mentally, because they have been bound in chains, they have been put in jail, and they have seen six of their children being mercilessly killed. Such is their agony that possibly they felt gratitude to God when the seventh child was a miscarriage. They felt that we won't have to witness a brutal massacre of our child. In that kind of feeling, Devaki has got pregnant for the eighth time, and she is dreading this, dreading delivery of the child. Little does she know that this delivery is something that is going to bring her deliverance.
And absolutely, and because the events which occur are totally not something they have witnessed even in the past six or seven pregnancies. Because even Swami beautifully writes, it's the night before the child is going to be born, and Devaki is lying there. She doesn't know what is going to happen. You know, this is the child that was, which was foreseen. But the moment the arrival of this child was foreseen and was foretold, so many years back itself, the life they led actually was only getting from bad to worse. So she was wondering what is going to happen when this child is being born. What will happen of me? What is going to happen of my husband? What is going to happen to this child? And Swami describes that scene. They are in the dungeon. They are in the prison. It's all gloomy. And there's one little lamp which is glowing in the corner of the cell. And she looks towards the lamp and she's wondering what is going to happen to me tomorrow. And Swami says, suddenly the lamp goes off and there's pitch darkness. Literally, it is the darkest hour, even physically there. And at that time, suddenly they sense a glow in that cell where they are imprisoned. And both Vasudeva and Devaki look up and they find this effulgent form, which is like a ball of light, which is approaching them. And they're wondering, what is this? For a moment, they actually think that it is Kamsa who has come in this form. And probably he has heard that it's the moment and he's come to finish them off or finish the child even before it's born. But even as they're looking at this glow of light, they find a peace and sense of serenity which cannot be associated with Kamsa, of course. And as they look on, they find that this ball of light is actually taking the form of that four-armed lord with a mace, with a chakra, with an abhaya hasta, the lord of Vishnu manifests in front of them.
And we can just try to imagine how it would have felt. And I'm sure at different points of time in our life, when we have had physically the darshan of Swami, this is how we would have felt. You know, we might not have faced a situation like Devaki or Vasudeva, but we have faced our own situations in life and we continue to face. And these are situations that make us also feel helpless, hopeless, so low, and feel that there is no end in sight, there is no light at the end of the tunnel. Because even as we are spotting the light at the end of the tunnel, like that lamp that gets extinguished in the prison cell, we see that light getting extinguished. Or as one comedian once said, I saw the light at the end of the tunnel only to realize that it was that of an oncoming train that is going to come and smash me down. At such times, you know, I was recently reading a book by Mr. Huxer, who happened to be one of the chairman directors of one of India's largest behemothic companies, ITC. And it's amazing to read his love and devotion to Swami, you know, in that book. Sadly, that book is out of print, but he has written a book called The Divine Manager, and he was called he was called to Bhagwan in the 1960s, and he held a huge position, and he held a very influential position, and needless to say, he had so much wealth with him. And yet he writes in the book how he craved for almost 7 years for Swami to look at him once. He was just hoping, and finally when it happened, he was so thrilled. He went on pestering Swami. He said, "Swami, I want to do something for you. Please give me the opportunity. Give me the opportunity. Give me the opportunity." Finally, he got his opportunity in 1986 when Swami started the School for Business Management, Accounting and Finance, you know, the MBA course. And Mr. Huxer played a pivotal role in formulating the syllabus and everything. So why I spoke about him is because when he writes in that book that he faced many situations, from his wife's health to important decisions that had to be taken, a decision that would affect so many, and he would have no idea of what to do, and he would feel very low. He would say, "All that I would do at that time is just come to Prashanthi Nilayam. Just travel to Prashanthi Nilayam." And he says that once I come here in the presence, and these are of times, interestingly, you know, when Swami began to speak to him actually is after he retired from the post. You know, logically it makes sense that when you're in that high position, you actually can utilize that person better. But no, Swami actually spoke to him and utilized his services after he finished his commitment and duty and after he retired. Not before that, because I think he retired in 1983 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he writes that in the time when he needed, when he was at the helm of affairs, when he was holding everything, in such situation, whenever he found the greatest problems, he would come to Prashanthi Nilayam. And it's not as if Swami would give him interviews or speak to him. He would say that, "I just look at Swami and all would vanish." And in the book he writes, "I want to tell all, if you have any trouble, whatever be the trouble, just come to Prashanthi Nilayam. Don't ask me how it will solve. Let me tell you, it will just solve. It will dissolve," he says. "It will dissolve." And I'm sure that most of us, many of us have experienced this happening in Bhagwan's presence. I say most of us, many of us, because possibly not everyone has like these kind of situations in life. There are those few blessed realized beings who are beyond the material world. But for us who are steeped in the material world, definitely we have had these lows. And at such times, a bhajan, a darshan just lifts us out of it magically. And after that, things seem to be fine. We can just imagine that is the kind of feeling Devaki felt. When that resplendent form of the Lord was before her, all her troubles, all her fears, all everything just vanished. She was filled with surging joy. And at that point in time, Vishnu also says what is going to happen. He says that, "I will be being born as your eighth child, and don't worry. Nothing will happen." And he then instructs Vasudeva that as soon as the child is born, as soon as I am born, carry me to Gokula. And you know, I think Vishnu is able to observe the look of shock on Vasudeva's face because he's in chains. He says, "You don't worry, the chains will fall off. Everything will be, you know, the path will be made for you. You just go and drop the child, drop me actually, at Gokula before returning." It giving these instructions, again the ball of light vanishes and the time is now becoming ripe for the birth of Krishna. But before that, dear listeners, we will take another quick little break, and after the break we'll be coming to this most beautiful moment, so don't go anywhere.
Krishna,
baro krishnaiya baro krishnaiya krishnaiya baro krishnaiya krishnaiya baro
ಕಿನಿಯ ಪೊಂಗುಳನೋ
ಉಡುಪಿನಿ ನೆರೆಯಾದಿ ಕೇಶವೇ ವಾಸ ಉಡುಪಿನಿ ನೆರೆಯಾದಿ ಕೇಶವೇ
Welcome back, dear listeners. And even as that beautiful song ends, and even as we wait for the advent of Krishna, just a few more thoughts before we move to that. A couple of these things which are happening in the story. One is, of course, that seventh pregnancy which we spoke about, where the child that was supposed to be born was Balrama, who is getting transferred to the womb of Rohini, who is indeed the elder wife of Vasudeva. And that is happening, and here is Lord Vishnu coming and giving this whole master plan of how the fetters will fall away, the guards will fall asleep, the doors will open, and you can do. This is happening after this couple, Devaki and Vasudeva, had to lose 6 children in front of their eyes. You know, for a father to see that happening to a child, happening to them, for a mother to give birth to a child and lose that child, knowing that it is not an act of nature or something, but you know, it's your own brother who is doing it. What a disastrous thing to happen. It's important, you know, when we are reading Bhagavatam, we always say this, we've said this even for the Ramayana, we are clearly seeing that this is a story of Krishna, and we are, to a great extent, we are dispassionate about the story. You know, we are seeing it as Leela. The reason why we are able to see it as Leela is we are seeing it from the point of view of see what Krishna has done or see what the Lord's play is. But when we are at the moment, we are not able to see it as Leela because we are seeing only that event. Right? Devaki is seeing that she has lost her child. Devaki is seeing that she is being imprisoned. And that is what will give pain, and that is exactly what happens in our life too. You know, when we see, look around, even in Swami's organization, even in our own life, we see small events and we are in pain, we are in confusion, we are in trouble, we are thinking that why is this happening? Why something bad is happening? Why this is going wrong in my life? Or why Swami is letting this happen in Swami's organization, or you know, devotees are going astray or whatever it is. It is because we are looking at that event. But when we look at the whole thing, we can never discount the fact that Swami is the avatar, Swami is the ruler of everyone's heart, and if he wishes, the prison doors will open, the guards will fall asleep, the fetters will fall away. If we always keep that in mind, we will see the whole thing as a Leela. But if we lose the picture of that, if we lose the image of that, then we'll look at the problem and we'll say, oh, why is this going wrong? And why is Swami letting this happen? And why is Swami lost control of the situation? You know, that's what occurs to us. But that is the role of a devotee. He has to always remember, he has to always operate from the role of a devotee. That my Lord is in control, Swami is in control. I might not be able to see how it is happening, but He is in control. When we are able to do that, we will be able to look at our own life like how we are looking at Bhagavatam, very dispassionately, seeing it as, oh, what Leela it is, and we can speak about it and, you know, revel in the glory of the Lord.
Absolutely, because as you pointed out, as of now, for us, the definition of Leela is something that happens to others. We also pray, you know, we also complain. Swami, why I am not getting experience? Why I am not being able to experience the Leela? It's because, how do I know that right now I am not part of the Leela? How do I know that? You know, because we are always searching things externally. And that is what happened even in the case of Kamsa versus Parikshit. Kamsa searched for that ultimate thing outside while Parikshit searched for it inside. You know, I remember this conversation, Brother Sai Prakash was narrating that when he had gone to Discovery Channel for a 6-month sabbatical and in order to pick up some skills from there, he met a wide variety of people and many of them were very, how you will look, how will an outsider look at Swami? Oh, you belong to a cult, you are behind that Sai Baba, all such things. And for 3 months, he had to face that. But slowly over time, seeing him, they slowly got drawn towards what is it that makes him stand out as a person? What is it that makes him so calm, so composed? Their admiration and, wonder about his own personality and character and nature made them actually start getting some respect towards Swami, you know. And that brings to mind what Swami says about be, do, see and then tell. Leadership is about being. If you just be, that's enough as the first step. Naturally, when you are, you will do. And these speak louder than, actions speak louder than words. And that is what happened in Sai Prakash's case. Why I narrated this whole thing is one interesting episode wherein one of his colleagues got into a long conversation, debate with him. Mm-hmm. And finally, it came to a point where he asked, okay, all that is fine, but now what about Swami's mission now? Who is the next? Who will continue this? Who is the next in line to continue this? And Sai Prakash answered him with a statement that just had him dumbfounded. He replied, how are you sure you are not looking at him right now? Okay? And that was, that comes from, that kind of an answer can stem from only a place of deep self-confidence. It was not something of a show. It is not like on day one in Discovery, Sai Prakash went and announced that, I am the chosen one to continue the legacy of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. No. That is show off. But this is confidence. This is a kind of confidence. And that comes when you have that within yourself, that kind of confidence comes only when you know that you have God with you. Because as Mother Teresa once famously said, with 3 pennies I can't do anything, but with 3 pennies and God, there is nothing that I cannot do. The most impossible things can be done. And that is what happened for Vasudeva to go towards Gokula. It is so beautifully summarized in a statement in the Bhagavata Vahini, Swami writes, who can hinder the inscrutable operation of the will of God? Can the divine mystery be penetrated and unraveled? Fools who cannot grasp the truth, who cannot recognize divinity and measure the power of God, who have no faith in God, they live in the delusion that their petty plans will save them and that they can triumph through their own efforts. This is the grandeur of God. Let us never forget that. Then only we will be able to see everything as a leela. Our own life is a leela. We seek experience, we seek leela, but we are not ready to accept the truth that possibly what is happening right now in my life is a leela of the Lord. It is a leela of the Lord. Let me just hold on in faith and confidence till the end. Let me be as dispassionate as I am when I am hearing about 6 children being killed. I feel no problem, let the 7th one also get killed fast, because then only Krishna is coming. Had it been one of my aunt or one of my friend, could I tell like that? Let 3 more children go, this is just a leela. It comes from that deep faith and basically surrender. Surrender that whatever is happening is for my good. In this context, just one little experience. I remember in 2013, I had been to a Sai center in Trinidad. Mm-hmm. And over there, the center was actually a person's home. It had been converted into a center. It was very well done, very wonderful. It felt very beautiful. After the bhajans, I wanted to meet the person whose home it is, who had given it for being used as a center. And they said that no, they live upstairs. First, I was surprised that they had not come for the bhajan. It was then that I got to know that the lady had actually undergone a surgical procedure and she was in pain and therefore she had not come down. So we went up to meet them. And then, she started saying how that she has been devastated because of what has happened. Her child had, you know, had breathed its last at birth. It was a stillborn, and they had struggled and strived for many years, and finally this child, and when it got delivered, it was dead. Just like, you know, how it happened in the case of Parikshit, when he was born and Arjuna was so devastated and depressed, and he went on to criticize Krishna. This lady was not criticizing, but she was just asking, why did Swami do this to me? And how do you answer this, Prem? How do you answer this? Because on one hand, I have no idea of the actual answer. On the second hand, I can't even properly empathize, because I will never know what that pain is. What is the pain of a mother who loses her child after yearning for the child for several years? At that point in time, you know, just prayed to Swami and told her that, you know, sister, this is very, very, very difficult. I will not be able to gauge your pain at all. But at this point in time also, if you can keep your faith in Swami, I am sure that Swami will take care. Not that if you keep, he'll take care. If you don't, he'll not take care. If you keep, he will take care and you will be even calmed. Please don't give up on Swami. Hold on to Swami. I had one Vibhuti packet. I gave it to her. And I said, you hold on to Swami. I'm telling you, it'll all be fine. And Prem, you know, it was half conviction and half hope. Because after I said that, I just closed my eyes and said, Swami, I've said like that. Please, please, I hope this will be fine. 2 years later, on Facebook, this lady messages me, sharing the photo of her daughter. Now she has actually got 2 children. And it's all wonderful, fantastic. And now, you know, it is a episode that I can possibly narrate in an afternoon satsang. But 3 years back, I would not have narrated it, because it looks like an apparent failure. There is nothing like failure. When they say God will ultimately triumph, if God doesn't seem to be triumphing, then it is possibly not the end. It is a leela in progress. I think it is so important that for our own peace of mind, we look at everything that is happening in our life and around us as a leela of the Lord in progress. And if we look at Parikshit, that is how he is taking everything. That is the reason he is not upset with the sage or his son who has cursed him. That is why he is not critical of Kamsa. He is able to take everything in equanimity, because though it is his own life involved, he is now got the ability to look at everything as just a leela of the Lord.
The other very profound thing which strikes me is, you know, when you read this, especially because we've lived with Swami, we're living with Swami, we are yearning for darshan of Swami or Swami to speak to us, we sometimes probably don't realize the value of what we are asking for. You look at Mother Devaki and say, oh, how fortunate she is. You know, to have the vision of Lord Vishnu like that, and he comes and says, I'm going to be born in your... I mean, what a scene it would have been. The Lord is in front of you, and he's saying, Mother, I'm going to be born to you. What a scene it is. But such a blessing was not given simply to that mother. You know, such a blessing did not come, you know, fall from the heavens to Vasudeva. What pain they had to undergo. What pain and suffering they had to go through. And it's unimaginable what they would have had to endeavor to find that light at the end of the tunnel. So I think that is something that we all have to keep in mind. It's not that Swami is going to make all of us suffer before he gives it to us, but any amount of suffering is worthwhile if that is what is going to come at the end of it. And that is something we have to keep in our mind. You know, you always, nowadays, because of social media, you have a lot of these images of, recently also there was a picture of somebody who scaled the Mount Everest. And, you know, this person scaled it. He was the youngest person to come, youngest lady to come, and youngest Indian to come, and all of those things. And you always think, oh, how beautiful it is there in the summit of Everest. But we have no clue of the effort which goes into that.
We see only the final photo.
Only the final photo. The scaling, what it takes, and the preparation for that journey itself. Years and years of effort goes into that. If that much is done for scaling a Mount Everest or scaling an earthly peak, imagine you're asking for blessing of the highest order from Swami himself. And I think that is the approach we should have. It's not that Swami is going to make me suffer, but any amount of suffering is worth it if at the end of it I'm going to get this blessing, any form of blessing from God. And I think these are the things which we probably overlook because of the familiarity which we have with the story. And when Swami writes it, that's why Swami gives so much emphasis to that. You know, he's saying that the whole description, probably much of it is lost in the English translation, in spite of somebody like Professor Kasturi doing the translation. I'm sure in Telugu it's much, much more poignant and beautiful. But what a moment it is that Lord is coming and saying that this is all will happen and I'm going to be born to you. Be prepared for that moment.
And as Krishna is born, a warm glow fills the entire prison. And as promised, the chains fall off. You know, in another discourse during a Krishnashtami, Swami mentioned this is what happens. The moment you pick God in your hand, the moment you pick up God in your life, the chains that bind you fall off. The moment you let go of God, the chains come back again. And that is exactly what happens to Vasudeva also, because the chains fall off, the prison doors open, all the guards are asleep. In the meanwhile, outside, it is the early hours of the morning. In fact, I think Swami gives even the time. He says 3:30 a.m. just before the Brahma Muhurtam. This is what is happening. And though it is so early in the morning, nature has woken up. Nature has this ability. Like when Swami was born, there were musical instruments that were playing on their own. Here, nature has woken up. The cuckoo is already, the cuckoo is already cooing there. And nature seems to be celebrating. There's a gentle rain that is providing that sweet scent from Mother Earth. But as Vasudeva is worried about the newborn baby, there is an umbrella that is formed by Adishesha, the divine bed on which Lord Mahavishnu reclines. That Adishesha comes and spreads its hood over this baby, and that is how Krishna is protected from the rain. There's an entire beautiful adventure that happens to Vasudeva, including the river Yamuna parting and giving way for him to walk across, because the Yamuna is in spate that time because of the monsoon rains. But it opens and gives way, and Vasudeva is able to place Krishna next to Yashoda, and he picks up the baby girl that is lying down next to Yashoda and walks back to the prison. Very interestingly, very metaphorically, very poetically, the moment Krishna is there in Gokula, before the description of Nanda, before the description of Vasudeva walking back to prison can be given, suddenly everyone there hears the words Krishna, Krishna. It is Parikshit. Parikshit is calling out, "Oh Krishna, Krishna." He says, "Krishna, Krishna." And with a gentle smile on his face, his eyes closed, he comes, he's reclining. It's over. And Shuka also now has a smile on his face, and he says that Parikshit has reached the lotus feet of Krishna. It is so beautiful that at the moment when finally the breath left him, it didn't carry any vasana along. It didn't carry any desire along. It only carried the sweet and liberating name of Krishna. And that is how Parikshit gives up his life. At this point in time, dear listeners, we feel it is very apt that we play out this one bhajan, because this bhajan in its words as well and as in its emotion, it conveys the feeling of a soul that is yearning and pining and craving for liberation. And ultimately that liberation comes and that soul is picked up from the Bhavasagara to the lotus feet of Krishna. We'll enjoy and immerse ourselves in this bhajan before concluding today's afternoon satsang.
Krishna, Sri Hari Krishna.
Krishna, Sri Hari Krishna.
Krishna, Sri Hari Krishna. ಮುಕುಂದ ಗೋವಿಂದ ನವನಿತ ಚೋರ ಗೋಪಾಲ
ನಂದ ಮುಕುಂದ ಗೋವಿಂದ ನವನಿತ ಚೋರ ಗೋಪಾಲ
ನಂದ ಮುಕುಂದ ಗೋವಿಂದ ನವನಿತ ಚೋರ ಗೋಪಾಲ
ಗೋವಿಂದ ಗೋಪಾಲ ಗೋಕುಲ ನಂದನ 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 ಗೋಪಾಲ
ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಶ್ರೀಹರಿ ಕೃಷ್ಣ
ಗೋವಿಂದ
ಗೋಪಾಲ ಗೋಕುಲ ನಂದನ ಗೋಪಾಲ
ಗೋವಿಂದ ಗೋಪಾಲ ಗೋಕುಲ ನಂದನ ಗೋಪಾಲ
ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಶ್ರೀಹರಿ ಕೃಷ್ಣ
And that is how Parikshit called out Krishna, Krishna, even as Sukha was finishing his narration of Krishna reaching Gokula and Vasudeva comes back. And he says Vasudeva actually breaks down the moment he comes back to the prison with that baby child. He breaks down, and at that very moment Parikshit calls out Krishna, Krishna, and everybody realizes that the moment has come. And there is a chorus of everybody joining in that calling out of Krishna, and everybody calls out Krishna, Krishna, Dwaraka Vasa, you know, Gokula Vihari, and all those praises are being heard. And even as this is going on, Sukamarshi gets up, you know, his task is completed. He looks at them and he says he has reached Gopala, prepared for his funeral, and unnoticed he just slips away from there. And so very beautifully Swami concludes that whole narration by saying, you know, Sukha Maharshi was like the parrot. You know, the word Sukha itself, the other meaning of that word is parrot. And he says, just like the how the parrot, and
in fact, in many depictions, Sage Sukha is shown as a parrot head.
Now, if you look at it, those of us who've grown up with gardens around, if you have a guava tree in your garden or any such, you know, fruit-bearing tree, they would always say that if you find a fruit which has been half eaten by a parrot, you would find that it'll be poked, it'll be bitten by, and in the process it would have fallen down. If you're lucky to find one of those fruits, you'll find that they are the sweetest fruits, because a parrot will always know that among the many fruits which are there on a tree, which is the most sweetest and which is the most ripe. And that's why Swami says, just like how the parrot picks that fruit which is most ripe and gives it, in the similar manner, Sukha has got the most ripe fruit, which is the name of Krishna, which can redeem, and he has given it to Parikshit, and through Parikshit he has given to all of us. And it is that's how Swami concludes this beautiful narration of the Bhagavata Vaini.
And that is how, dear listeners, we will conclude our experience of going through this beautiful book called the Bhagavata Vaini. We sincerely hope that you have all enjoyed and benefited with this satsang, because we surely have enjoyed and benefited by it. We are grateful to Swami for this opportunity. We are grateful to Swami and all our listeners who gave us this opportunity of Kirtanam. It is always beautiful, wonderful to keep reliving the glory, the Bhagavatam, and for us the Bhagavatam somehow always gets intermingled with the Sai Bhagavatam. It has been a very pleasurable experience, and it is just gratitude that is welling in our heart for this opportunity. Also, there is that little tinge of feeling that we'll miss the Bhagavatam. But that feeling can be evaporated soon, because the Bhagavata Vahini is available for us. We sincerely hope that this entire satsang that has lasted over possibly a year and a half or maybe more will inspire all of us to pick up the Bhagavata Vahini and compose our own Bhagavatam with the Lord in our hearts, in our lives. With that, we offer this entire effort at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan with gratitude. We will conclude with
We would like to conclude with this song, which is in fact a prayer written in Hindi very beautifully. It is in fact probably the prayer which was there in Parikshit's mind. And we'll conclude with this song, Let It Be Our Prayer Too, to Swami. On the other side of it, as always, you'll be joined by Chandu with his program, Love to Love. Thank you. Happy listening.
Itna to karna Swami, itna to karna Swami, itna to karna Swami, jab pran tan se nikle, Govind naam lekar tab pran tan se nikle, Shri Ganga ji ka tat ho, Jamuna ka vanshivat ho, mera saavra nikat ho, jab praan tan se nikle, peetambari kasi ho, chavi man mein ye basi ho, peetambari kasi ho, chavi man mein ye basi ho, hothon pe kuch hasi ho, jab pran tan se nikle, jab kanth pran aaye, koi rog na sataye, jab kanth pran aaye, koi rog na sataye, yam daras na dikhaye, jab pran tan se nikle, उस वक्त जल्दी आना, नहीं शाम भूल जाना। उस वक्त जल्दी आना, नहीं शाम भूल जाना। राधे को साथ लाना, जब प्राण तन से निकले एक भक्त की है अर्जी, खुद गर्ज की है गर्जी। आगे तुम्हारी मर्जी, जब प्राण तन से निकले गोविंद। गोविंद नाम लेकर तब प्राण तन से निकले।